In the early 1990s, I was living in a grotty little rent-controlled apartment. It was only $200 a month, and it felt like it. It included heat, hot water, and electricity, along with all the pains of having a shared bathroom, and it often left me with a feeling that I could probably be doing much better. But it was really conveniently located next to Harvard Square, and I had a bunch of stores that I would visit on a regular basis, not to buy, but to visit. Places I could fool around in for hours, bookstores that I could wander around and read in, all sorts of toys and gadgets and media. There was one experience, though, that I look back on and I realize it was a pivot of what I thought computers could do and the kind of fun and the kind of worlds that changed for me, once again, my relationship to them and my feelings about what they were capable of. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd, Peter Healy, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. The store in question in Harvard Square was an educational store, a store that had puzzles and games and scientific experiments that you could do at home. It was, sort of, related to the local public television station, in that it had branded items like VHS tapes and references to the television shows. But primarily, it was for kids to get kits where they could learn things. And in previous visits with my haunting through of Harvard Square, I wouldn't spend too much time in there. I might get some astronaut ice cream, I might read through some of the books, but there wasn't much for me in that place. But then, and I remember that day as clear as glass, I was in the back area of the store, where they had the computers, and normally they had educational software and software that was meant for learning. But I walked up to this Macintosh, and on the Macintosh was some sort of image. It was an image of an island, some sort of natural setting. And the mouse worked. I could move it around and click on things, and it would change the perspective of what I was looking at. That in itself wasn't that impressive, but as I'm sitting down in this store with kids running everywhere, I realize the clicking can go on forever. I can click on a pier and walk down it. I can click up a hill into a building, and it will keep showing me things. I can keep moving down staircases, and one after another, it's showing me what's down there. At the time this is all happening, that's not normally what you would get. Computer games were going to be single or multiple megabyte affairs. They couldn't afford to have endless landscapes or endless pictures. You were going to have something pretty limited, probably as a background, and the real action was taking place in the foreground. This was different. Place after place opened up to me, and they were weird and fantastical. They had hints of brass and gold and luxury that I just wasn't prepared for. It felt like Captain Nemo's submarine was stranded on an island. Minutes turned into hours, and while I had long ago stopped hearing the screaming children, it wasn't until someone walked up to me that I realized I was the last person in the store. The game was Myst. It had been created by Cyan Software, and as I found out later, was a hack of HyperCard of epic proportions. It was completely a rebuild of what a HyperCard stack could be, and it involved so much processing at the time that they weren't completely sure it was even technically feasible. The Miller family, who had put this game together, were already pretty experienced in exploring things. They had created a game called The Manhole, whose entire purpose was for you to click around, try things, be sucked into this fantasy world as a kid where everything became another thing, from a chessboard to a landscape to a river to a sewer, and everything became everything else. But that was in black and white. This was in color. It had sound. It was, at the time, incredibly immersive. I could not hope, at the time, living in my rent-controlled apartment, to ever afford the powerful Macintosh that could play something like this. It was going to be, and it was, years before I could afford a CD-ROM drive, which was a requirement to play Myst. And so, a few times after that, I was able to sneak into a few stores that had Myst running, play around with it a little more, realize that it was puzzles and levers and different kinds of actions needed to find even more amazing worlds, and I was really not at all equipped to be able to do anything about it. Years later, I played it with a family who had the machines to do this, and it was really eye-opening how far down this game could go. But back then, in my era of a black and white Macintosh at home, an Amiga that I was able to be given for free, it was an unattainable level of computer power that was extending in front of me. A pretty common misconception I used to have with computers in my early years was the idea that the computer was creating, on the fly, the worlds I was in. If I ever saw a game that had more than a few levels, maybe 5 or 6, or changed up some aspect of the environment, I had a habit of convincing myself that this thing was doing it on the fly for me and only me, and that as you went along, you were building with the computer a whole new world. Anybody who knows the slightest technical information about computers, especially in the 80s, knows this is fundamentally not true. It's only really very recently that I have encountered an actual experience like that, where people use artificial intelligence routines to generate new text adventures on the fly. They're weird, they're clunky, and they don't always have a theme. You certainly don't find yourself at the end feeling like you've taken a journey with a human hand. But instead, a machine that's meant to imitate writing has been going on for quite some time, and your mind hasn't had anywhere it can find a pattern to recognize. Myst was created, in every way, by the hands of the Millers and the rest of the people at Cyan, to be a complete world, to be a story of family troubles, of human and intellectual endeavor, and a hint of fantasy about the nature of writing that you are playing a part in. Besides the power of the extensiveness of the world, there was power in the narrative. And it stuck with me. Only a few times after that day have I felt the same about a game. And in most cases, it's been a shadow of that, me convincing myself it's similar. It's pretty neat when a game has a lot of levels or a lot of rooms, but it only feels that way until you realize that some sort of editor has put it all together, and it's not really meant to tell a story in the same way. One very strong exception to that has been The Witness, the puzzle game created by Jonathan Blow that is such a craft in terms of its environment and your interaction with it. It almost trips over itself trying to be fully immersive. I was playing it again recently, and I realized how easily frustrating it can be because the game insists on not really giving you hints, on not really requiring you to understand every concept in it as you move on. To its credit, it's possible to solve the game without solving every last puzzle. But for a certain kind of person, that's the worst dangling of a reward you can imagine. The Witness is a lovely game. Jonathan Blow, not quite so much. He's had to resort to removing old tweets on a regular basis just to ensure he doesn't have people actually read them after he writes them. Not so with the Millers. The creators of Myst have turned out to be just as lovely people as I imagined they were back when they were playing parts in the game 20 years ago. They're creative. The building that Cyan Interactive is in is lovely. They crafted it with the same approach that they did the Myst game, so pictures of their offices are as much of a wonderland as opposed to a lot of other game companies that just end up being an office building tucked away. I know they've had open houses on a few occasions, and it's definitely on my bucket list to be there someday. While the world's become so distracting, so full of different things to see, and with so much content for us to find, I am very sure that in the years to come, I'm going to find another Myst, another Witness, another case where somebody worked incredibly hard to craft a world that draws me in, makes me want to be part of it, and hands me just enough tools to become a wanderer, a discoverer, and maybe, especially the first time, not to look up again until someone taps me on the shoulder and informs me, "Dude, you gotta go." That's a pretty exquisite lighthouse that I know I'll be rowing towards in the fog. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to Emilio Oliveira, Forrest Fuqua, James Bakoyanu, Mark Pilgrim, Scott Roseanne, Scott McGrady, and Corey Thomas, along with the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. Normally, I'd point out to you where on the Internet Archive you could play Myst. And the fact is, you can play Myst anytime you want. That game has sold so many copies and has had so many remakes that it's just effortless for you to go spend a few bucks and play it. It's had sequels, some of them have been great, some of them not so much, but the fact that over a quarter of a century later, this game is still so compelling to so many is a testimony to what fundamental wonder the Millers tapped into.